Shvius Perik Yud Mishnah Aleph 10:1. We now begin a new topic altogether. The halachas of Shvius, so the Shemitah year, have two separate applications. The first being Shemitah's Karkaos, the resting of the land, which applies only in Eretz Yisrael. And that was the topic of our first 9 chapters. This 10th chapter discusses Shemitah's Ksafim, the release of loans. And that applies both in Eretz Yisrael as well as in Chutz La'aretz, outside of Eretz Yisrael. The consensus of the poskim and the psak of the Mechaber and the Shulchan Aruch is that nowadays it's only rabbinic. The requirement of relinquishing loans is a rabbinic requirement and it will not be a Doraisa, a Torah requirement, until Yovel is back in effect, and that requires the majority of Jews to be back in the land of Israel. The Ramah takes even potentially a more lenient position. In any case, our mission will focus on the basic applications of this principle. What's important to understand is that the halacha differentiates between loans per se and other types of debt. And although loosely we'll refer to Shemitah's Ksafim as debt relief or the relinquishing of debt, that's not strictly true. It's specifically loans that are released and not other kinds of financial obligations. Most notably, the Mishnah will distinguish between store credit. That is, say you go to the, like in Israel, you have the makolot, you walk into the small shop and you buy a carton of milk, and you don't pay now. It just goes on your tab till next time. That is store credit, and hakafas chanut, it's called in the Mishnah. And such store credit is not considered to be a loan because really it's payable immediately just for the sake of mutual convenience. The basic tacit understanding is the next time or one of the next times that the purchaser comes back into that shop, he will pay his tab. And therefore the shop owner is just sort of extending this credit for the sake of mutual convenience, but not agreeing to it being a loan, which would have some future specific payoff date. And I think the easiest way to understand the difference between a generic loan and this store credit loan would be that the difference is that there's a specific date upon which it's payable. That is to say, if there's no specific date in which it's payable effectively right now. It's just a matter of I'm letting you not pay me now for whatever reason. So that is considered store credit and is not released by the Shemitah. Whereas if it's a formal loan which has some specific due date, then it would be released. Also worth noting, of course, is that such a scenario is not a loan where I'm giving you money and expecting money in exchange. It's actually the other half of the transaction where the storekeeper gives milk and expects payment for the milk in exchange. So the failure to pay immediately makes it just an extension of credit, but not a loan for some future repayment in a subsequent date. Okay, so let's see the Mishnah inside. There's a lot to talk about. The Mishnah says Shvius, the 7th year, and actually the halach is that the relinquishment of these loans, the Shemitah's Ksafim, occurs at the very end of the 7th year, at the proverbial stroke of midnight on the end of the 7th year, or in fact it would of course be Rosh Hashanah with Shkia. At that point, or Tzeis of Chavim, whatever it is, at that point the loans are released. So the Mishnah says here, Mishametes es hamilva bishtar v'shalo bishtar. The Shemitah passing, the Shemitah's Ksafim, is effective on releasing loans that are made both bishtar with a contract and below bishtar without a contract. Here, at least according to the halacha, we go like Rav and Shmuel, that the contract we're talking about is one that specifically encumbers some asset. So there's a lien in the contract which says, like a mortgage, I'll lend you $100,000, but I have a mortgage on your home. So that, because there is a loan with a lien, there's an encumbrance on your home, the mortgage, that's called milva bishtar. But the fact that it happens to be written on paper is not relevant. There's no collateralization, no lien. Then the loan on paper is as good as a milva shlo bishtar. It might as well be ba'al peh, a verbal commitment. So the point of the mission here is that both verbal as well as written contracts, and even written contracts that have specific liens on assets, are all released in the Shemitah year. And that's significant because we'll see in a little bit that when there's a real asset that's a pikadon, that's like a collateral, it's acting as surety, that security is in the hands of the lender. So then it's as if that loan's been collected already and Shemitah will not release that loan. So let me just clarify. Our Mishnah is saying, if I have a lend you money and I, in the contract of the loan, it says, I have the rights to collect from your home if you don't pay me. That's called a milva bishtar and Shemitah will release that. However, in contrast, if I lend you $100 and I, instead of having a contract which says I could collect the $100 from your property, I actually take your fancy pen, which is worth $100, and I hold that as my surety, that's my pikadon. So then, Shemitah would not release that loan. The $100 that you owe me would be collectible after Shemitah. It's based on a pasuk, but conceptually, the reason why is because it's not that I have a claim on you, it's I actually am holding already the repayment in my hand. I have that pen in my hand, so I'm holding it already, almost as if it's been collected, and therefore I'll have to give you back your pen if you give me the money, but Shemitah wouldn't release you from that loan because I'm holding that surety, that pikadon in my hand. So again, here the Mishnah says that it's Shvius, the seventh year is Mishmetis as a milva bishtar. If there's a contract, even if there's collateral, but it's just a lien, financial claim on a future asset as opposed to a physical possession of some asset, so then the Shemitah will release it, and same Shalom Bishtar if there's no contract at all, or there is a contract, but there's, you know, lien in the contract. In contrast, Hakafas Achanut, store credit, an extension of credit, as I described before moments ago, and a Mishametis that isn't released, because it's not considered a loan, it's just the other half of a transaction, and the storekeeper's not lending you money. They're just letting you not pay immediately for a mutual convenience. The Mishnah, however, says it's a gray line, and if the im asa milva, if the shopkeeper converts that store credit into a loan, that is to say the storekeeper agrees, you know, you can pay me back on the 30th of the month after you get paid, that became now a loan, not just store credit. There's a fixed date at which it's repayable, and that being the case, it's now been transformed from merely store credit that wouldn't be released by Shemitah to being a loan, which is now released in the Shemitah year. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, HaRishon Rishon Mishamet. Rabbi Yehuda, who the halacha does not follow, reasons that each time that you go back into the store and you buy another bag of milk, another bag of milk, another bag of milk, each time that when you bought that second bag of milk and didn't pay for your first bag, so you already see right then and there that you're not paying immediately, and therefore the original credit is being converted from not just a credit, and now you owe the store some money for the first bag, but now it's become like a loan because you could have paid it but didn't. So that's Rabbi Yehuda Shita, that each time you go in, in subsequent times that you go to the shop without paying, the previous debt converts from being store credit, which is not relieved by the Shemitah, to a loan made by the store to you, which is indeed released in the Shemitah year. However, the halacha does not follow Rabbi Yehuda, meaning store credit, even if it's multiple episodes over a period of time, doesn't change the fact that it's still store credit, payable immediately, and is not released by the Shemitah. Sechar Sachir, the payment for a worker, person's wages, Eina Mishamet, again, those aren't released. That is to say, of course, person works for you for whatever it is, a month, and you haven't paid him yet. The fact that you didn't pay him before the passage of the last day of the Shemitah year doesn't mean you're overlooked from paying him. You have a debt to him, but it's not a loan. And therefore it's not released. But there's similarly this kind of gray area, the imasal milva, if it's converted to being a loan, that is to say, for example, you make up with the worker, okay, listen, I owe you the money, but I'm going to pay you in a month when I meet the employer, gets, you know, my next deal closed. So we've transformed it from being, wages that are payable immediately. And even if they weren't paid in the interim of the course of the month, it's because for mutual convenience, we do, you know, payroll twice a month or something. But if I make up with you, I'm going to pay you now in 30 days and some future date, and it becomes payable then. We've converted the wages owable, which wouldn't be released by Shemitah, to being a loan, essentially, that's being extended effectively from the worker to the employer to be paid in 30 days. And now the employer gets relief at the passage of Shemitah, would release that loan. Raise a Mishamet, Shemitah year would actually release that loan. Rabbi Yossi has an interesting idea. He says that's true for most workers. However, kol malacha sheposekas b'shvias, any type of work for which wages were earned, and that work is forbidden during the Shemitah year. So in other words, this worker was hired to pick grapes, and now he wasn't paid before Shemitah rolled around, and now he hasn't been paid throughout the whole Shemitah year. So Then Shemitah will, Mishametah, Shemitah will release that money owed to the worker, because since his work can't continue through a Shemitah year, it's as if it's automatically converted from being some wages owed from the employer to being a loan being extended to the worker. And therefore, once Shemitah rolls around and finishes, actually, then Mishametas, it will release the obligations of the employer to that employee. However, again, the halacha does not follow Riosi here. V'she'enu posekes b'shvias, any other kind of work such as Riosi, which wouldn't stop during Shemitah, meaning the employment is the guy's a lawyer or a bricklayer or something, and he could work in the seventh year. So then, ena mishametas, Shemitah rolling around wouldn't relieve the employer from paying his employee even after the end of Shemitah and the start of the eighth year in the cycle. 10.2. The point of the first part of this Mishnah is a continuation of what we said before in the previous Mishnah, that the moment where the loans are released is the very end of the seventh year. As the Pasuk says, Miketz Sheva Shanim Ta'ase Shemitah. At the end of the seventh year will be the Shemitah at the very end. That's what it says in the Devarim Tesvav Pasuk Aleph. So the Mishnah comes to illustrate that point. Now, the way we'll illustrate it is talking about if two people go into partnership over a cow, they're going to slaughter that cow and use that cow to make a big barbecue dinner on the first night of Rosh Hashanah. So Rosh Hashanah is a two-day holiday, as we know. But the truth is that at least in the time of the Mishnah, prior to the predetermination of the calendar, so Rosh Hashanah, the first day, could either be the last day of Elul or the first day of Tishrei of the next year, depending on whether or not there are witnesses who came and testified they saw the new moon. Since it was not determinable in advance, the word would be hard to get out in time. So the custom has been since a very long time to keep 2 days of Rosh Hashanah because of that doubt. And that continues till today, even though there's no longer any doubt, but we still keep 2 days of Rosh Hashanah as back then. So the point of the Mishnah is that if two people go into partnership with a cow, and one lays out the money and the other owes him reimbursement, and that occurs on the last day of the seventh year, so then comes the next day, the second day of Rosh Hashanah will be the first day of the eighth year, and that debt will be released because it was a loan that had to be repaid and no longer has to be repaid since Shemitah canceled it. Whereas if the first day of Rosh Hashanah turned out to be the first day of Tishrei, meaning the first day of the eighth year, so then the deadline of the end of the seventh has passed, and therefore the money that the one laid out to the other and was to be repaid must still be repaid because there's no release of that loan. The way that the Mishnah describes it, it talks about a chodesh mu'ubar, which literally means a pregnant month. In the Mishnah, at least, we're referring to mu'ubar, pregnant month meaning a month that has 30 days, as opposed to 29 days. And a chaser, a deficient month, is one that only has 29 days. Just in case you aren't clear, the reason why that happens is because the Jewish month is based on the sighting of the renewed moon. And the moon's cycle from one renewal to the next is 29 and a half days, which means sometimes the renewed moon is seen after 29, which means sometimes a calendar month can be 29 days long because the 30th day marks the beginning of the next month. And sometimes it can be 30 days long because the Rosh Chodesh, the new month, is declared only on the 31st day from the previous time. It was Rosh Chodesh. So that being the case, the Mishnah says inside, Hashochet es hapara, if a person slaughters a cow, v'chilka b'Rosh Hashanah, and he divides it with, let's say, one other person, on Rosh Hashanah, each of them using the cow for meat, for dinner, let's say, on Rosh Hashanah, im haya chodesh mu'ubar, if Elul, the last day of the year, was mu'ubar, literally pregnant, meaning it was a 30-day month, and that being the case, the first day of Rosh Hashanah actually was the 30th day of Elul. And really that the end of the 30th day of Elul is when the Shemitah release of loans will occur. So then Mishamet comes the next day, the second day of Rosh Hashanah. Now we're a new year, past the seventh year, and the money that was owed from the one fellow to the other for his half of the cow is now released. Ve'im lav, but if that month was not, meaning the Elul was not a mu'ubar, wasn't the 30th day month, but rather was a chaser, a 29-day month, so then ena Mishamet, then the loan that was extended for the meat of the cow occurred already on the first day of Tishrei, which is the first day of Rosh Hashanah, and the second day of Rosh Hashanah will be the second day of Tishrei. And that being the case, since the loan happened on the first day of Tishrei, it's the beginning of the eighth year, and there's no release of loans. In case you're wondering, why would it be, in the previous Mishnah we said that if you go to the store and you buy meat on store credit, so then if you pay the next day, if you would intend to pay the next day, let's say, Shemitah wouldn't relinquish it because it's just store credit, and Shemitah doesn't release store credit, whereas Shemitah does release loans. The question would be, why should it be that to the store, the loan or the would-be loan is not released? Why should it be that in the previous Mishnah, the debt owed for the meat to the store is not released, whereas in our Mishnah, the debt owed to the person who laid out the money for the cow is yes released? So one answer is that it's perfectly normal to go into a shop, at least in time of the Mishnah, and not pay immediately, but just have store credit and have a tab that you repay from time to time. Whereas when it comes to two individual persons, it's not normal for one to lay out money for the other, and then when the one gives, let's say, the meat, to not be reimbursed immediately. That's normal. So by not being reimbursed immediately, it automatically becomes that the one is essentially effectively lending money to the other for later repayment, and that's why between two persons, it is mishamet, the loan does get released, whereas in store credits, person to the store, it is not the case. The Mishnah goes on to say that various penalties that are imposed by Beis Din, such as ha'onis, v'mafata, v'moti shemra, I'll explain in a minute, all those things, and v'chol ma'asa Beis Din, the truth is any writ, decree from a Jewish court, the Beis Din, that requires someone to pay something. So, enam mishamtin, those obligations that are imposed by the court are not released just because of Shemitah. So that is to say, for example, I broke your window, the business is out there, repay you $100. That's not a loan to you, that's a financial obligation based on the Beis Din. And that being the case, if Shemitah passes, it doesn't make a difference. I still owe you $100 for your broken window. That would be chol ma'asa Beis Din, any other rabbinic requirements from a court. These cases, onus mafata and moti shemra, are three cases where there's a penalty imposed based on from the Torah in various psukim. The onus is the rapist, so a person rapes a woman, then he has to pay 50 shekels. Mafata is the guy who seduces a woman, so she has her options. Either she can get married to him if they want, and if not, the mafata has to pay 50 shekels. And the moti shemra is a person who falsely claimed that his arusa, the woman to whom he had entered into the first step of marriage, like given the ring under the chuppah, but hadn't completed the marriage with Nesuin, they hadn't lived together as husband and wife. In the time of the Mishnah, those two steps in the process were separated by a year often. Now we do both steps essentially within the course of a few minutes. Under the chuppah, the ring is given, that's ready to the erusin, and then chuppah occurs, you know, the same night, maybe immediately, whatever constitutes Nesuin, and chuppah is whatever it is. Different opinions, but the point is it happens all at once, basically. Whereas in time of the Mishnah, we would have first the erusin, the first stage of marriage, and then she, the woman, would continue to live in the home of her father for another year, let's say. So if the husband, I'll call him, falsely claims that she actually was adulterous in that period, and turns out she wasn't, so then he has to pay a fine as a moti shemra, as a defamer, of 100 shekels. So those obligations of the onus mafata and motzi shemra, and the truth is kol ma'asa Beis Din, any other rabbinic court enacted obligation, enin mishamtin, is not released by Shemitah because those are not loans. Hamalva al mashkon, also if a person lends in exchange for some kind of physical surety, the collateral he gets in his hand, as I explained in the previous Mishnah, that is to say, I lend you $100, and in exchange, you give me your $100 pen as a surety, as a collateral. So since I'm holding the pen already, now such a loan is considered like as if it were collected in some level, and I have it in my hand already. And that being the case, Shemitah does not release it. If, just to illustrate the point, hypothetically, I loaned you $100, you gave me a $60 pen to hold as collateral, so $60 worth wouldn't be released. The remaining $40 would be released, however, because it was uncollateralized. So that's malva lamashkon, as opposed to the previous Mishnah where I made the point of saying a financial lien, an encumbrance on some property in a contract, that's milva b'shtar, that is released. But if you're milva alamashkan with a physical surety, not released. And similarly, hamoser shtars lebezdin, if a person hands over his contract to be enforced by a court, so then en meshamtin, no longer are those loans released in the shvita year, because the pasuk specifies release of your brother, but that means if it's a fellow Jew who holds the obligation, then that loan is released. Again, it doesn't really matter if the person who owes the money is rich or poor. The point is just that it's the creditor is an individual person. Whereas if it's been handed over to the Bezdin, so and the Bezdin now has rights to claim on this contract or this loan, whatever the story is, so then Pasuk does not relieve the person who owes that debt on that loan. If the Bezdin holds claim to it, the Bezdin is not your brother, and the Bezdin is not, that loan is not therefore released. And so once handing over to the Bezdin, Shemitah doesn't relinquish and relieve the person who owes on that money, and that will become the basis of the topic of the next Mishnayos, the Prozbul. Yod Mishnah Gimel 10:3. We now come to the topic of the Prozbul. Now, the Prozbul was a mechanism which allows the lender to circumvent the effects of Shemitah's Ksafim, the relinquishment of obligations to repay loans. The backstory is this. In the time of Hillel, so that is really the beginning of the first century of the Common Era, right before the end of Bias Sheni, the destruction of the Second Temple, Hillel observed that despite the fact the Torah forbids with the force of a mitzvah not to resist lending money as the time for Shemitah's Ksafim approaches, the Torah warns against that. It calls it a davar bliyal, which means like a terrible thing in your heart. The Torah says you shouldn't think such a thing and not lend money. But in practice, Hillel observed people simply were not lending money for fear of losing the rights to reclaim their principal. And that being the case, Hillel decided to rely on what essentially is the loophole that's built in to the previous Mishnah's halacha, that when a bezin, the court, holds the rights to collect on a loan, so then the loan is no longer released in the Shemitah year. So Hillel essentially set up a way that everybody would lend in the seventh year in such a way that the loans would not be released, and because they're formally all assigned to a bezin, by mechanism of this prosbo. It's a discussion, an important discussion in Yevamos about exactly how and, you know, why the rabbis would sort of circumvent the spirit of the Torah. If you understand, like, as I said before, the Shulchan Aruch does, that until Yovel's back in effect and until the majority of Jews are back in the land of Israel, the halachas of Shemitah's Ksafim are all rabbinic in nature. So it's not such a big deal, and as much as Hillel is changing the rules doing a takana, exploiting this loophole for the sake of you know, sidestepping a rabbinic requirement. It becomes more momentous if Hillel intentionally sort of circumvented a whole area of Torah. The Torah clearly wants the release of loans, and yet Hillel found a way to sort of sidestep that issue. Be that as it may, that's exactly what Hillel did do. So there's such a thing called prosbol. Now, the word prosbol is actually a Greek word, which means something like application or enactment. As is the case, the Gemara gives a Hebrew twist to the Greek word, and therefore it understands that prosbol is some kind of enactment that serves the bully, the rich people, and also the buti, the poor people. In fact, prosbuli buti might be the full long word for it. In Greek as well, in fact. Be that as it may, the prosbol became a Hebrew word, which means simply this mechanism by which those who extend loans can assign their loans to a bezin so the loans can be collected after Shemitah is over. So the Mishnah says, prosbol, when using the prosbol, eino mishamet, the loans are no longer released by the Shemitah year. Ze echer min hadavarim shetikin hilil hazakin. The prosbul was one of the things that Hillel Hazakin, who we call Hillel, the Hillel, he was mitaken. He established kishara shenimnu ha'am milahalvos zedze. when he observed that the nation refrained from lending one to the other, and they who failed to lend violated the Torah, which explicitly said in the Torah, Hishamar lacha, you should be careful, pen ye davar im levavcha bli'al, lest you have a wicked thought in your heart, etc., meaning not to lend. The puzzle continues on, Leimor karvish nasa sheva, the seventh year is approaching, shnasa shmita, that the year of relinquishment is going to happen upon me. V'ra'inecha b'achicha avyona, you'll have, you know, turn a wicked eye towards your impoverished brother, below seat and low, and you won't give him the money he needs. That's bad news, but Hillel said, although it's bad news not to give, people were in fact not giving, and the Torah's Hillel did a takana therefore. Now, I'm going to speak for just a minute here. Rabbinic enactments come in two basic flavors. There's the gezeras and the takanas. The majority are gezeras. A gezera is like a fence, a protective fence, like keder, a protective fence to ensure the Torah's doraisas are kept, and there are fences around the Torah to make sure that no one inadvertently or accidentally or over time society comes to conduct itself in such a way that the Torah's doraisas are being abrogated, they're being transgressed. That's a gezera. A much less common thing is a takana, which means like a fix, a repair, like tikkun, is typically where the rabbi saw that although the Torah is perfect, society is not perfect. And since society is not upholding what the Torah expects of it, so some sort of tweak now is required to address the fact that society is failing. So it's in a way like takana is always sort of the lesser of two evils in the eyes of the rabbis. That is to say, we want the Torah to be in effect in its perfection, but since society is either changed or not living up to their expectations, so this is, you know, the lesser of two evils, and we put in a takana, some kind of fix. So that's the case over here. The Torah is a setup where rich people should lend to the poor, and there should be debt relief every 7 years. And that's, of course, for the benefit of the poor, so they should have, you know, like bankruptcy law, a chance to start again. Once the rich are no longer lending to the poor because they're afraid of this debt relief, so the bottom line is the people who are going to suffer are the poor people who can't get loans and can't make ends meet. And therefore, Hillel felt that in order to keep the spirit of the Torah of enabling the poor to have access to funds, he employed this principle as a way to circumvent the Torah's release of the loans, although that's circumvented in the Torah's principle. It is still for the benefit of the poor people, and much, much more so, meaning it's a better option than the alternative. So that's a takana, where the rabbis are going to change something based on a change in society. Here, the change in society is people failed to lend in the seventh year, and therefore Hillel got involved making the prosbul. So therefore, Hiskin, Hillel, prosbul. The Mishnah says, therefore, Hillel, in fact, made this takana, this repair in society with the prosbul. Shvius, Perek Yud, Mishnah, Dalet, 10:4. We continue the topic of the prosbul. Hillel's takana that allows lenders to circumvent essentially the spirit of the Torah, to be frank. You'll note the Torah has three separate mitzvahs regarding debt relief. The first being that one indeed should release, the loans are released at the end of the seventh year. The second, that one may not press, loyigos, you can't press the one who owes you money to repay. And the third, that one should not withhold loans and resist lending money as the time for the remission of loans, the end of Shemitah, approaches. That's a separate law all to itself. And yet, as we saw in the previous Mishnah, Hillel saw that the fact was lenders were not lending and the people suffering were the poor. And therefore, he established the prosbul as a way to circumvent a legal loophole, to circumvent this the issue altogether, the phenomenon of debt remission, so that people would continue to lend. So the mission here says, what is the prosbul? What is the actual document that is effected, the content of it, so that debts are not released? Zehu gufo shel prosbul, says the Mishnah. This is the essential component, the ikar, this essence and shorish, the root of the prosbul. Quote, a person says, Moser ani lachem ish ploni ufloni, hadayanam shub makam ploni. I am informing you, certain judges. It mentions ploni uploni as if there are two judges, and there are those who take it seriously that there only need to be two judges, but most go that you need a bezin of three. And in fact, some Rishonim require like a weighty substantial bezdin, although the custom has been to use even lesser betedin, just regular people of three. Shabamakam ploni, in whatever good place they're in. Shakol chov shiyeshli, the variety of loans that are owed to me. Here, the chov is an asset. Let's say I have, like, let's say an IOU with the rights to collect from somebody else. So that chov is an asset that I have, the right to collect. So I'm handing them over to you, the bezin, as if they're yours, but then you are entitling me to collect those loans that have been handed to the bezin, as if I'm acting on the bezin's behalf or my own behalf. Shegvenu kol zman she'erza, that I will collect upon them whenever time I so desire. The idea being, so we're missing a bunch of words, the idea being that the loan is, the rights to collect the loans are first being handed over to the bezdin, and therefore we rely on the notion of the bezdin's loans are not forgiven just because Shemitah passes. And then, where we are appointing me, the person who extended the loan, to be the one to collect the loans on my behalf. So the thought was that I'm asking, so to speak, the bezdin to collect my behalf, but if they're not going to do it, I'll do it for them, i.e. for me. V'hadayanam chos min lamata, and the judges will sign at the bottom of the prosbol, o ha'edim, or the witnesses can. According to the Bartanura, the point here is that usually when it comes to contracts, there are witnesses who are distinct from the dayanam. The bezdin doesn't act as a witness, but in the matters that are derabbanans, like a prosbol, it's allowed. So here the point is either the dayanam themselves can sign as edim, or the edim can be the dayanam, they can be one and the same, or not.
Maseches Shviyas, Perek Yud, Mishnah Hey, 10:5. This Mishnah will continue to discuss the halachas of prosbol, but actually has three separate topics. The first topic will discuss prosbol per se, and we'll discuss if a prosbol is predated or postdated, if it's kosher. And then we'll talk about shtarei chov in general, loan documents. If one has a loan, and one writes a loan as a lender, and he predates or postdates that loan document, will that contract still be kosher? And then finally, we'll discuss how many different prosbols a person must write. That is to say, if there's one lender and five borrowers, or five lenders and one borrower, etc. We'll discuss that in its proper time. So now, let's go to the first part of the Mishnah, prosbol and its dating. To understand the Mishnah, I think it's best just to get an intuitive feel for what it's trying to address here. Let's say one is writing a prosbol on the 10th of the month, but he dates it for the 20th of the month. What would that do? That would effectively say that the new loans that he extends between the 10th and the 20th are going to, according to the contract anyways, not be forgiven with Shemitah. They won't be released. Whereas, of course, that's a lie. Since the contract was written on the 10th, the loans he extends after the 10th really should be released with Shemitah. So, therefore, when one post-dates a prosbol on the 10th, right, dating at the 20th. So really, he's cheating. He's cheating the borrowers who the Torah is trying to protect. And that being the case, we're going to say when it comes to a prosbol, to post-date the prosbol is not acceptable and makes the prosbol invalid. On the other hand, let's say one predates a prosbol. So now let's say the guy is standing on the 20th of the month, and he writes a prosbol and he dates the prosbol for the 10th of the month. So what's going to happen? The loans that happened between the 10th and the 20th, even though if he would have properly dated the prosbol, he, the lender, would have been protected. But since he predated it to the 10th, he messed himself up. And those loans he extended between the 10th and the 20th will indeed be relinquished with Shemitah. So the only person who's losing is him. And that being the case, we're not going to have a hakpada. We're not going to care if he wants to mess himself up and predate prosbol, but we will say a postdated prosbol is not valid. That's what the Mishnah says inside. Prosbol hamuktam kasher. If you predate a prosbol, you date it earlier than the actual date. You're sitting on the 20th and you date the prosbol for the 10th. Absence the only person who you're messing up is you, because loans that you extend between the 10th and the 20th now will indeed be relinquished come the deadline in Shemitah year. So therefore it's kosher. The prosbol is okay and effective. However, v'hamuchar, if you post-date it, meaning again, you're standing on the 10th and you date it for the 20th, so now loans you make between the 10th and the 20th, according to the contract, the principal will be you'll be protected on them, messing up the borrower, and that's sort of cheating. And therefore, pusl, the Mishnah says, such a post-dated principal is pusl invalid. Okay, that's the first part of the Mishnah. The second part of the Mishnah is going to talk about shtarei chov. A shtarei chov is simply an IOU, a debt contract. So in an IOU, the psak will be the exact opposite, meaning now we're going to say that if it's mukdam, it's pasal, and if it's a mukhar, if it's post-dated, it's going to be kasher. But let's think through the rational why, and then we'll worry about the words. So this is more involved. When it comes to an IOU, a debt contract, that contract actually has two separate functions. When I lend you $100, according to Torah law, I get a contract that says you owe me $100. So that loan contract from you to me serves two separate functions. First of all, it says I can take you to Bezin and get my $100 back. And second of all, it says that if you don't have the $100 that I want to collect from you, so then now I have an automatic lien on all of your real assets, on your property. So in the modern day, when you borrow money from the bank, you could borrow money from the bank and not necessarily give a lien on your home. It could be a non-recourse loan, for argument's sake. But in the Torah's setup, every loan automatically, one accepts upon himself, automatically his real assets stand as a surety, as collateral against that loan. So that'll mean if I lend you money, the $100, when I come to collect it from you next year, if you don't have the money, I can automatically essentially, take the money out of your real estate. I can force you to sell your house or whatever, your apartment, and then I'll get paid back like the bank does with the mortgage. Now, what happens if in the meantime, between the time when I loaned you $100 and the time when I claimed it back and you couldn't pay it, what happens if you sold that apartment? So now a new person has the apartment. Well, just like with the bank, there's the equivalent of a title search. And whoever had the earliest claim on that real estate, he's the one who really gets first dibs on it. That means that in the case I gave you before, if I loaned you $100 and you didn't have the money, when I come to collect from you a year later, if you don't have the money, I can go back and collect from your apartment. And if you sold it to somebody else in the meantime, I can go to that person and say, listen, you didn't have clear title. This property that you bought was already, lien to me. It was already a collateral for a loan I made. And I can essentially reclaim my debt from the property from the new buyer. Why is that the case? Because my loan preceded his purchase. I loaned the money last year and he only bought the apartment this year. So when he bought the apartment, it already was encumbered. It already had a lien against it. The same way as if I have a mortgage on my house, if I sell my house to you, the bank says that's all very nice that you've bought the house, but we have a mortgage. We get paid first. We get, first dibs on the money that comes out of the sale. So that's the setup here. So that being the case, the loan document is providing two functions. First of all, proof that there's an IOU. And second of all, it sets the date for when the lien attached itself to the real property, to the real estate. And that's very important because we need to know, did I extend my loan to you before or after you sold it to that other guy? If my loan came first before the sale, then I can go to the other guy and say, listen, the house is already encumbered by my lien. On the other hand, if first the sale happened and then the loan happened, I can't go to that guy who bought your apartment free and clear and tell him, listen, you defaulted on a debt to me, because he'll say, what do I care? When I bought this apartment, there was no encumbrance, there was no lien on it. So therefore, the dating of a shtar chov is essential to establish who the proper pecking order, who has rights and claim rights to real property. That being the case, if a person wanted to be a cheater, so he'd be interested, of course, therefore, in changing the date of a loan contract to be as early as possible, because that will give him the ability to have potentially more real estate to be, collateralize his loan. That being the case, if you predate a shtar chov, that's cheating, and therefore we're going to say it's pusl. If you post-date it, on the other hand, who are you messing up? You're only messing up yourself. The lender's messing himself up, because now it just means there'll be less property which I can you know, call on in the event that my loan defaults. So then the gist of the Mishnah therefore will be that a predated shtar chov will be hustle, and a postdated shtar chov will be kosher. Okay, and that's what the words say, but we're not done with this. The words say shtar chov when it comes to general loan contracts, IOUs, hamukdamim psulim, if they are predated, they're pasul, and vahamucharim, if they're postdated, then kasher. That's what we said so far. Now, there's a little more complexity here. When we say pasul and kasher, do we mean that, let's think it through, the dating on the contract only does one thing. It solves the question of who has first dibs on the equity in this real estate. What about the fact that the loan was made? If I have a loan to you and it says I lend you $100 and I dated it, you know, the wrong date, but it's a legitimate loan, money traded hands, you signed, I signed, in the case of Jewish stars, actually, the witnesses signed. So the loan really happened, okay? The problem is the contract has a technical problem, which was predated. So the question is, should that make the whole document's garbage and useless? Or should it just mean that since it's predated, it's not valid in terms of deciding the pecking order of who has claim on the equity in the real estate, but the fact that the IOU still is effective shouldn't be affected. So that is a machlokas Rishonim and a machlokas between the Mechaber and the Raman and Shulchan Aruch. So according to Rashi and the Rambam, Mechaber, all that the predated shtar chov, the predated loan contract, is possible, it's invalid with respect to using it as a tool to collect on other real estate that's, you know, passed out of the hand of the original borrower. In other words, since the contract it was dated incorrectly, you, lender, have no right to collect or even attempt to collect from a property that was meanwhile sold to another person. But as far as just the using the original loan contract, which was misdated, to collect on the original $100 that you loaned, that should be fine. That's what the Mechaber paskins. However, the Ramah paskins, like Tosfos, who holds, listen, pasul is pasul. If the contract is not valid, it's not valid at all. And being that it's an invalid contract, the lender can't collect even the $100 with this contract. It's just a totally invalid contract through and through. So it's a Mechlokas Mechaber Ramah. Fine, that's that. Ashkenazim presumably go like the Ramah, of course, right? And Sephardim like the Mechaber. Okay. That brings us to the last part of the Mishnah. This part of the Mishnah also is straightforward and should be kind of intuitive. Let's just think it through first before the words. So how does a prosbul work? A prosbul says that me, the lender, all of my loans are being handed over to the Bezdin for collection, which means if I made 100 loans, I need exactly one prosbul. On the other hand, if a borrower borrowed from 100 people, so then the fact that there's a prosbul that releases him from one particular loan doesn't mean the other 99 aren't released. So that being the case, the Mishnah says now, Echa lova mechamisha, if a person borrows from 5 separate lenders, kosa prosbul l'chol echad ve'echad, there needs to be a prosbul written for each of the 5 loans, because it's focused on the lender being able to collect his loan back by handing his loans over to the Bezdin. If there are 5 lenders, they need 5 prosbuls. On the other hand, chamisha loven me'echad, if 5 different people borrowed from 1 lender, in a kosa velesh prosbul echad l'kulam, then the lender can simply write 1 prosbul for all 5 loans and hand that 1 prosbul over, you know, handle those 5 loans effectively to the Bezdin all at once with a single prosbul. Okay. Shvius Perik Yud Mishnah Vav 10:6. The Mishnah now speaks out an additional clause regarding how prosbul is going to work. Prosbul requires that the borrower, the debtor, the person who owes the money, has some rights to some real estate in some small way. The reason the rabbi set that up is sort of up, it's a bit of machlokas, and it's quite technical, but so I'll give a simple explanation. Let's keep it at that because it doesn't really matter so much for our purposes here. The mechanics. The idea is that real estate can't really be stolen. It's always there, and therefore just sitting waiting to be collected on. And that being the case, it's as if the Bezdin has already collected it because it's waiting to be collected. And therefore, when one hands over his loans to the Bezdin for collection, it's like they collected it immediately because it's just waiting to be collected. Then it's there to scoop it up because the real estate sits where it sits. And as far as real estate having value, well, the value of the real estate doesn't necessarily need to be on the open market equals the value of the loan. And one possible explanation why, straightforwardly, is that real estate really doesn't have an objective value. Every parcel of real estate is totally unique, and different persons see different value in it. So we're not going to worry about the pricing of the real estate per se. But the technicality remains that the Chazal wanted it, that if you're going to write a prosbol, that the borrower must have some rights to some real estate somewhere. So just to illustrate, Bezman Azen, now times, assuming a person's not homeless, so then wherever he lives, meaning he has the right to live somewhere, where he pays rent or he owns an apartment or he's sharing a room in a dormitory, anything like that, that's all sufficient. Any kind of rights to any piece of land anywhere would be sufficient property on which to write a prosbol. But as the Mishnah will say, if a person had literally nothing, he's totally homeless and has no property rights anywhere, meaning the lender, will need to assign something, some real asset to him, some real estate to him, even if it's tiny, to make the prosbol work, just based on how the Chazal decided to set up prosbol. So it's a technicality. And that being the case, the Mishnah says, Ein kosfin prosbol ella al hakarka. One only could write a prosbol based on the fact that there's land somewhere, rights to some real property somewhere in the that belongs to the borrower. Im ein lo, if the borrower simply has none. Shvius perik yud, Mishnah Zion 10:7. This Mishnah talks about a kaveris. A kaveris is a beehive, and it's a synthetic beehive that people make to raise bees and get honey. Now, for reasons I cannot tell you, every time the Mishnah talks about a kaveris, it's a difficult Mishnah. This Mishnah, the exact focus of the Mishnah is actually a machlokas to the Meforshim. I'm going to go with the Bartanura's pshat, even though it doesn't conform with the Halach Lamaisa, to the extent there is Halach Lamaisa here. Just because the Bartanura's pshat is much easier, and because Bartanura is our hero, we always follow Bartanura. So I'm going to go with him. And if you want to look deeper into this Mishnah, you're welcome to look at the other Meforshim who understand it differently, but for a variety of reasons, more difficult way. So the Mishnah is talking about a kaveris, the beehive. And the case here is a beehive that's sitting on the ground, but not actually attached to the ground. So the question is, does the beehive have a status of karka, of ground? And the idea would be that since the beehive really, while not physically attached to the ground, is intended to stay in place indefinitely, so it's sort of, let's call it conceptually, perhaps, it's machlokas here at the time, perhaps ground. It's like attached to the ground because it's not going anywhere, not meant to go anywhere, it stays permanently there forever. So the question therefore becomes, in the Mishnah, does such a beehive have the status of karka, of ground, or no, it's like any other movable object, and the fact that it's intended to stay there forever doesn't make a difference. And the Mishnah will discuss a variety of different practical ramifications of whether or not it's considered to be the ground. So the punchline will be that Rabbi Eliezer holds that it is like the ground, and the Chacham say, no, it's not like the ground. Okay, and the Halacha will be like the Chachamim, meaning it's not like the ground. So the Mishnah says inside, a kaveris devorim, you have a beehive. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, harei hika karka, it has the exact status of being ground, even though it's not attached to the ground. And there being the case, kos fin alei prosbol. First of all, that's our point of departure. If a borrower has a beehive that's sitting somewhere, even if he hasn't got rights to the land beneath the beehive, he has no rights to put the beehive down there, it's just a beehive sitting around somewhere, says Rabbi Eliezer, the beehive has a status of karka, of ground, and therefore a lender could write a prosbol against it. Also, since it's considered to be ground, ena mikabelas tuma bimkoma, provided it's still in the place where it belongs, in its permanent place, so then this beehive, although it's got a status of a kli, of a utensil, because it's this man-made artifice thing to raise bees, and it could be normally considered to be a kli, because you make a kli out of things that grow from the ground, like wood, so such a kli, as long as it can hold things like a beehive can, is, yes, susceptible to tuma, mekabelas tuma. However, there's a general rule that when anything is attached to the ground, It's mechubar lekarka. It's impervious to becoming tamei, of receiving tumah. And that being the case, since the kaveras is considered to be part of the ground, according to Rabbi Eliezer, it will be impervious to tumah. It's, as the Mishnah says, ve'enam kabelas tumah. It won't receive tumah. Again, bimkoma, provided that the beehive is in its proper place. It hasn't been dislodged from where it belongs, in which case it would be like any other movable object and would be makabel tumah. And finally, baharod memena b'shabes chayev. Now the word rode, radia, means to take down. It usually applies to taking bread out of an oven. It's a borrowed term here, really. We're talking about removing a honeycomb from within the beehive. So if the beehive has a status of ground, to remove the honeycomb would be like detaching the produce from the ground. And on Shabbos, one cannot do that. There's a malacha. One of the malachas is kotzer, is harvesting, is detaching things that are attached to the ground from the ground produce. And if you treat the kaveris, the beehive, as ground, so then removing the honeycomb is like detaching foodstuffs that were attached to the ground. And therefore, harod memeno, if one detaches honeycomb from the beehive, since it's considered to be ground, if you do it on Shabbos, chayev, you are obligated to bring a chata, so you do an isra d'oraisa of detaching from the ground. If you're scratching your head thinking, wait a second, even if it's like ground, it isn't actually ground necessarily, to that, so the Bartner brings a pasuk to support that, because the pasuk says v'yitbol osa b'yar osa devash. Pasuk in Shmuel talks about, it means dipping it in the forest of honey, and of course honey is not a forest, so what could forest of honey mean? It's coming to teach you that the honey, well, in the honeycomb, is treated as if it were a forest, things that are attached to the ground, and therefore one is obligated, is chayev, to bring a chatas. He breaks the rice of Shabbos if he harvests honey from the honeycomb. You'll please forgive me, my voice is getting hoarse, I don't know why. In any case, the chacham disagree, the chacham omrim enaka karka. The chacham say no, beehive is not considered to be ground, it's not attached to the ground, it's just it's a kli. And that being the case, they disagree on all three of those points. First of all, they say, therefore, the ain kotzim la prusbol, you cannot write a prusbol based on the borrower having a beehive, because it's like him having a briefcase or having whatever, you know, a garbage can. Doesn't justify itself as being ground. So no prusbol. And second of all, mekubelas tuma bimkoma, it can receive tuma, it can become tummy even if it's in its place. Meaning, since it's just a cleat, it's like a, you know, I don't know, it's a garbage can or a basket sitting on the floor, it can be mekabel tuma as appropriate. And finally, v'harod memena b'shabas pator. If one detaches honeycomb from the beehive, since it's not considered to be the ground, there's no such thing as causing it, looking at it as being like a derice of harvesting of coats or harvesting produce from the ground. Therefore, one's exempt. As far as yaros devash, the pasuk, so it's very possible that the expression yaros devash is referring to not honey in a beehive, but rather sugar cane growing. And the word devash in that pasuk is referring to not honey but sugar. And the yaros devash is the collection of sugar cane. That is a possibility. Fine. The halacha is going to be like the chachamim, meaning that according to the Bartanura, a kaveris, a beehive, does not have the status of ground, so you can't write a prusbol, it's on makabel tuma, and you're not chayav on Shabbos if you take the honeycomb out. As I said, the Bartanura's pshat is his pshat, and more or less his pshat alone. It doesn't seem to conform with, it's based on the Yerushalmi, not the Bavli. The Bavli seems to disagree, and the other Mefarshei HaMishnah go with the Bavli's approach. Therefore, they understand the whole Mishnah is talking about not the status of a beehive on the ground that's not attached to the ground, but rather it's talking about the status of the honey in the beehive. But that's more difficult to explain in the words. And like I said, I'm sticking to the Bartanura, which is the policy of this year anyways. We stay with that. And if you want to investigate further, you are certainly welcome to.
Shvius Perik Yud, Mishnah Ches, 10:8. We just discussed the notion of prusbol, that there's a workaround where loans, for whatever reason, may not be released after Shvius. But that's certainly not the Torah setup. The Torah setup is that at the very end of the seventh year, as this clock strikes Shkia, at the last day of the Shemitah year, all loans are forgiven, as we said in the beginning of the parak. The question here in our Mishnah is, what happens if after the loans have been released, the borrower still wants to return money that he borrowed from the lender? So the Mishnah says, Hamachazir chov b'shvius. If one wants to return and repay the balance he took after shvius, now b'shvius literally would mean on shvius, but that's impossible. It means after the Shemitah year is completed, meaning we're now in the beginning of the eighth year, and the loans have been formally released by the Torah. So it doesn't mean shvius literally, and in fact, if you look in Devarim 31:10, you'll see that the Torah does refer to the beginning of the eighth year in the context of Hakel as shvius. So we're talking here about one who wants to repay once the seventh year is over and the eighth year has begun. Yomer lo, the lender must say to the borrower, Mishamet ani, I have relinquished the loan. I released the loan, and there's nothing more to repay. Amar lo afal pikein. If, however, the borrower says, nevertheless, I want to give back money, I don't want to keep what wasn't originally mine, then yikabel memeno, then the lender is permitted to receive money back from the borrower. Now it has to be lahalacha, it has to be that the borrower not only understands that he's giving this back not as a repayment of loan, because the loan is gone, but rather simply as a gift, a return of money that's in the Torah's gift, in the pathway of just, it's a gift. And so much so that actually he has to be explicit. The Shulchan Aruch Poskim say that the lender has to wait until the borrower says explicitly, this is a gift that I'm giving to you, not a repayment of the loan, before he is entitled to accept that money. Interestingly, the Bartonura speaks out that when the lender says that you don't need to repay me because the loan's been released, he is even allowed to have his hand stretched out to accept the cash that's being offered. So the lender has to put the borrower notice that the loan has been relinquished and there's nothing more to talk about, end of story. But he is totally within his rights, the lender's within his rights, to accept money from the borrower, provided the borrower understands that this is just being given in return as a gift. Fine. This is actually based on a pasuk that he needs to speak out the fact that it's been relinquished, and he has to respond by saying, it doesn't matter, I want to give it back to you. Shneamar, the pasuk says, Zed Dvar Hashmita, this is the word, the dibor, the speech that is associated with Shmita, meaning that a person must simply say that I have released this loan and that's all, and that's sufficient. One time is enough, and after that, if the borrower wants to give back the money, he is allowed to, again, provided, of course, that he understands that it's a gift. Now, Kiyotzebo, a similar principle applies in a totally different, unrelated context. We're talking here about an accidental murderer. The halachas of this is a little involved, and we'll discuss it in Makos Bez Hashem, but in short, if a person kills inadvertently with some degree of negligence, so it's sort of a middle case, he wasn't totally, he wasn't willful in killing, the murderer didn't kill intentionally, but also it wasn't a total freak accident that could never have been avoided, it's somewhere in the middle where there was negligence involved. So then the murderer is required to go into Gullis, to an Ir HaMiklat, a city of refuge. More on that later, another time. In any case, the point is that if such a person, an inadvertent murderer, is in this city of refuge, the question is, what if the people in that city want to give him some kind of honor? They want to give him, they want to call him to an Aliyah in the Torah, something like that. So the Mishnah says, Kiyotzebo, the same principle applies. Rotzeach, if you have a murderer, Shegala le'ir miklato, that has been exiled to his city of refuge, v'ratzu anshia ir l'chabdo, and the people of that city want to bestow some honor upon him, yomer lehem rotzeach ani, he's required to put them on notice that I am a murderer. Amar lo afal pikein, if they choose to respond and say, nevertheless, we want to give this honor, then yikal b'mehem, then he may indeed accept the honor, that's okay. But he must put them on notice. Shneamar, as the pasuk says, v'zeh devar ha-rotzeach, this is the matter of the murderer, but we are in a darshan devar, it's meaning dibor, there's required speech that must come from the accidental murderer, and that speech is putting on notice someone who wants to honor him, that indeed he is a rotzeach. Shvius Perik Yud, Mishnah Tes, 10:9, the last Mishnah in Masechta Shvius. The previous Mishnah focused on the obligations of the lender to relinquish for real the loan and not reclaim it, and even to demur and tell someone who wants to pay him back he need not, by letter of the law. Now we focus on from the perspective of the borrower, whether or not he ought to repay the lender now that the loan has formally been relinquished. So of course, the letter of the law is that he need not. But should he? The Mishnah says, well, hamachazir chov b'shvias, if a person who had borrowed money now repays the money that he borrowed, even as we saw in the previous Mishnah, as a gift, as return gift, because the loan itself, of course, has been annulled, it's gone. When it says b'shvias, once again, here we mean after shvias has passed and the loan has been totally annulled. Ruach hacham nocha hemeno. The rabbis are proud of him. Literally, the words mean the spirit of the rabbis are pleased with him. Something like that. So the Mishnah is emphasizing that while there's no strict obligation by letter of the law, it's the right thing to do if one is able to. And the rabbis smile upon such behavior because that's the proper behavior. The purpose a person was created for in this world is to earn his place in Olam Haba and not to be a taker. He should be a giver. He should be one who contributes to society. He shouldn't. The whole purpose of existence, the Ramchal describes, is that a person should not have na'ama dechisufa, bread of shame. He should earn his bread and therefore, by rights, have something to call his own in Olam Haba. So we're here to emlech Hashem, and just the same way God is if you could say something positive about God, would be that he's an independent giver. He's, you know, and indeed, a person ought to be an independent giver to the extent he's able to. So if this person's lot in life is to be impoverished and he can't return, so then that's fine. That's how it is. But if he could, the borrower did have the money and is able to return the money that he now has that originated in someone else's pocket, he ought to. And if he does, the rabbis give their blessing to him. They're pleased with his behavior. Similarly, a different case, we're now leaving the topic of Shemitah altogether and to discuss two other cases where by strict letter of the law, one is not obligated to follow through on something, but if he does do it, it's the right thing to do. And again, the rabbis are pleased, they're proud with him. The Mishnah says, Halova min hager, shnisgari im banav, imo. If a person borrows from a convert who has children who converted with him, lo yachshu levanav, then the borrower need not return payment to the convert's children. Let me explain. First of all, this has nothing to do with Shvias. We're moved away from Shvias. We're talking about just generic loans, you know, in the middle of the Shemitah cycle. In year two, I borrow money from a convert who converted with his children. And in year three, I want to repay it. But then the person from whom I borrowed, the convert, he dies. So he has heirs. But by a strict letter of the law, when a person converts, he is as if he's a newborn child and he has no yichus. His family tree gets a new trunk. He's not connected to his forebears directly. So that means that technically speaking, at least from the Torah perspective, the children of a convert, like if they converted both, so these converted children are not actually members of the same family tree as their father anymore. Each have their own family tree, if you will. And since they're not his legal children, not miyuchas after him, they're not attributed to his line, so then they are not, from a Torah perspective, legitimate, necessary heirs of the father, because they're unrelated to him in a way. So that being the case, by strict letter of the law, a person who borrows from a convert, whose children also convert, don't need to repay the loan to the children, because the children aren't really, from Torah law, legitimate heirs, but it's the right thing to do, and if one does, Ruach Hacham no chemenu, the rabbis are proud of him. They have pleasure in his proper conduct. Just to clarify this, when a non-Jew does inherits from his father, and a Jew inherits from his father, the case is when you have a convert. When you have a convert, so he, like I described before, starts again a new family tree, if you will, and therefore he's disconnected from his father's family tree, and therefore not a direct inheritor. Now, just to simplify for a second, let's just say you have a convert. Should a convert inherit from his father? Not this case, just any case. Should his convert inherit his father's ancestral plot or something? A non-Jewish father. So we actually discussed this in the past, and we said that, this was in Demai, we discussed it, that the rabbi said that even though midoraisa from the Torah law, the convert isn't connected to his father and wouldn't be a legitimate heir, midorabanan we do allow him to inherit from his father. And the reason why is because we're afraid that if that wouldn't be the case, the convert would relapse back to essentially like renounce his Judaism because he doesn't want to forego whatever inheritance he'd otherwise be entitled to. So the rabbi didn't want that. So we said, okay, so let the child inherit from the father rabbinically. So our case here in the Mishnah is where the adult convert had other children, the children converted also. So those children really benefit from the status we described before. They should be inheriting from the father, midrabbanan. So if the lender, if the borrower repays back to the children as would-be heirs or heirs to rabbanan, so to speak, to the father, that's where the rabbis have pride and pleasure in the repayments of the loan. Partenora learns that in the case where the child wasn't yet born at the time of the father's conversion, let's say the child was already conceived by the mother, but then the father converted after that conception, so then this child never was entitled to, would have never been entitled anyways, no matter how you slice it, to be an inheritor of the father. And in such a scenario, to pay such a child actually wouldn't be particularly gratifying to the Chachamim. Okay, the last case, the Mishnah, is talking about, again, something totally different. We're talking here about keeping your word and the rabbis being satisfied and proud of that. And the case is where one gives his word to make some kind of acquisition. So we discussed actually a couple of Mishnahs ago regarding the beehive that the modes of acquisition, the kinyanim, are different for metaltalin, chattel, movable objects, as compared to karka, real estate, fixed in the ground assets. So when it comes to metaltalin, movable objects, we said that the way in which one acquires that movable object is by lifting it up or taking it, hagba, taking it. So for example, if I'm selling you my pen, and I say I commit to selling you my pen for $10, and you say I commit to buying your pen for $10, those words don't do anything. In fact, even when the $10 are handed over, that doesn't do anything. What makes the pen transfer from person A to person B's ownership is when person B takes a hold and picks up that pen. And until then, the transfer hasn't happened. So that being the case, our mission is saying if people come to a verbal agreement to make some sort of exchange, some kind of transaction, by letter of the law, they could back out. But if they don't, then the rabbis are happy. Again, Rucham Nochemenu, the rabbis are pleased with that and are proud of that proper behavior. Mishnah says inside, when it comes to movable objects, the mode of acquisition always is by taking it. In truth, normally that means hagbah, lifting it up, but whatever is appropriate is appropriate. You have to take the object which is being transferred, not just give money and certainly not just commit verbally. And whoever sticks to his word and follows through on his commitment to enter the transaction just by verbal commitment, even though by letter of law he doesn't have to and he could back out, the rabbis are proud of his activity and approve of it because that's the right thing to do. Let me just clarify two important points on this. You may recall we actually discussed previously the idea of the curse of the rabbis called Misha Para, which is short for it means the one who paid retribution to the generation of the flood will take vengeance on you too. Which is a curse. So Misha Para applies when money has already been given over for the transaction. That is to say, I say, I'll sell you my pen for $10 and you give me the $10. Then I come back tomorrow and say, I changed my mind. Here's your $10 back. So to back out at that point, once you've already given me the money, although again, the pen was never picked up. So the kinyan didn't happen. It still isn't really my pen. And technically I could back out, but that's terrible. And the rabbis say somebody who does that is subject to the curse of Misha Para. Our case in our Mishnah is where there's no transfer of money at all. It's just we agree verbally that we agree, okay, I'll sell my pen tomorrow, you give me $10 tomorrow, and we'll meet back here tomorrow for the transaction. So, and then tomorrow when I show up, I say, you know what, I've changed my mind, I don't want to sell it to you, I want to keep my pen. So that's within my rights, but if I do follow through despite that and give you, sell you the pen and take the money, that is where the Rucham Noche Hemenu. So if you back out, once money's been given already, that's already Misha Par, you're subject to a curse. But if you don't back out, and once you've just given your verbal commitment, that's already subject to a blessing of, so to speak, of Ruach HaChom Nochemenu. Just worth noting, halach lamaisa lamaisa, if a person enters into a verbal agreement, but then when it's time to carry through on that agreement, he would be entering a loss. And if I agree today to sell you my gold bar for whatever it is, $500, but then overnight the value of gold moves drastically. Now, if I follow through on that sale, I'll lose money. So then, it's a machlokas poskim if it's necessarily the right thing to do for me to keep to my word, even if it's if I'm gonna lose money. So if that actually happens to you, you'll ask a shala. And with that, Bez Hashem, Selk Masech HaShvias, we finish Masech HaShvias, and Bez Hashem, the next Masech is Masech HaShvias Trumos.